This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight we have with us Dr. Gerald Schroeder, who is, from what I understand, a theologian and an MIT physicist, and we're going to talk about his book, The Science of God. Gerald is with us from Israel tonight. How are you, Dr. Schroeder?
Pretty good. I could be a bit better. My voice would be scratchy.
Oh, man. I know you get 5 o'clock in the morning there. I'm so sorry, but I am grateful to have you.
I'm happy to be with you.
So I want you to take, we have 55 minutes, and I have a lot of questions for you. So I want you to take just a couple of minutes and give people a little bit, tell people a little bit about your background and where to find your work, you know, where to find you on the Internet, and how to get a copy of this book.
Okay. Do you want me to describe that?
Yes. Just tell us a little bit about your background and where what you're saying.
I live in Israel now, but I was raised in the States, and I studied at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where I got my bachelor's degree, my master's degree, and my doctorate. And then I stayed on the physics department for 7 years. Did a lot of work with weapons control and nuclear weapons and that. In that work, I actually witnessed the detonation of 6 atomic bombs, which makes me feel we want to make the world safe for peace, because a little bit of uranium turned mountains into wildly shaking bowls of jelly. I moved to Israel, joined the Weizmann Institute of Science, and then the Volcanic Institute of Research, and had labs at the Hebrew University. That's the academic background. So thank God I had a lot of science behind me. The theological, about 25 years ago, I would say 20, 25 years ago, I started getting interested in this interplay between science and the Bible, and primarily Genesis chapter 1, because my kids would ask me questions. Our kids, Barbara and my kids, would ask questions. How can the world be 6 days from the creation, and how does life exist anyway? You know, these basic questions that I always felt had answers. And in the science verses, or in conjunction with the biblical claims, and I discovered as you study deeply enough into the ancient commentaries, they match so closely to the modern science that it's almost unnerving. And so in all of my work, I only use ancient biblical commentary, the Hebrew commentary that goes back 1,000, 2,000 years, and modern science, no modern biblical commentary, because all modern commentators on the Bible can always bend the Bible to match the science, or bend the science to match the Bible. But but when you're dealing with ancient commentators long before the discovery of Cro-Magnon, Homo sapiens sapiens, going back ages, and long before the discovery of the Big Bang creation of the universe, and long before the discovery of E equals MC squared, that famous equation by Albert Einstein, how energy and matter are interrelated, long before those, these ancient commentators, the major ones, I don't use any minor commentators, the major commentators, all had an understanding of nature that is only being revealed now in the 20th and 21st century as being in totally in confluence, in agreement with the modern understanding of the world. Free will was never a problem. So that pretty much allowed me with what led then to writing my first book, Genesis and the Big Bang, and then the second, The Science of God, was trying to answer these questions. But it was never aimed this at being a book. I didn't think my entire doctorate thesis at MIT was only 50 pages long, which is a short doctorate thesis in general. And so writing a book didn't even enter my mind. But through a series of really wonderful coincidences, an agent, a literary agent, was visiting Israel, and decided to, and phoned up Barbara and asked and Bob immediately invited her to have dinner with us on a Friday evening. And that Friday evening just happened to be the weekend we were reading the first chapter of the Bible, the creation chapter. So I gave her the word of Torah. The editor, Ellen Reese, the agent didn't say a word. As she walked out the door at the end of the meal, we had a long conversation, nothing about a book. At the end of the meal, she turned around and said, "Jerry, what he just said is a book. Write it." So I wrote it.
It's a great book, Jerry, and it's got, you know, I think I told you, I was shocked that you weren't totally aware of all the other things that's going on in scientific research of consciousness, but your book presents new information for people to consider. I think it's a wonderful book. I really, really enjoyed it. So now I want to ask you some questions, and I'm going to ask you a few questions at the beginning. I'm going to warn you. I had dinner with a friend of mine tonight who is an astrophysicist who is also into consciousness, and he wanted me to ask you a couple of questions, if you don't mind.
Okay. We should tell the listeners, I haven't been primed for this. This is right off the top. Okay.
Right. It just came to you, right? You didn't spend years writing this book. It came to you, right?
Well, I spent time writing the book, but... I was referring to the fact that the questions you're asking...
I'm sorry. Yes, you're just flying off the top. This is just your opinion, and I want you to understand I understand that. So the first thing you want to... Because he's real into proving consciousness with science as well, but he had some questions that he'd like to see what you wanted, that you would say. So he wanted to know, first of all, do you think that Judaism stands superior to, say, Hinduism or Buddhism? And if you did, or the Sumerians work, he wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Okay.
I know that's a hard one, and it's not in your book. But
well, it's also politically quite sensitive. You always like to be politically correct. However, I would say I don't know all of the insights that the ancient commentators of the other Eastern religions have, but we do know that in the book of Genesis, we see that the first of the patriarchs, Abraham, after the first of the matriarchs, Sarah, dies, Abraham then is still alive and remarries, has more children, and he sends all the other children off to the east, explicitly. He sent the other children off to the east with gifts, and can all of ancient commentary, Hebrew commentary on the Bible, says the gifts that Abraham sent east were portions of the knowledge that he had discovered with God.
Okay.
So that the Eastern religions were primed with this information. Whether they're at the same level, I'm not enough of a student of them.
What he was really curious from is he was under the impression that Hinduism was 6,000 years older than Judaism. Do you have no? I don't have a clue. Do you know?
Not in written form.
Okay.
Not in written form for certain, because the first writing goes back to hieroglyphics goes back about the time of Adam. About used to be under 6,000 years.
Okay.
So. And
right.
The biblical revelation is about 3,000 years ago.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be good.
So the
Hinduism is at least an old religion, but I think what I would say is the following, that if we're dealing with a system that claims that there's a level of consciousness, I mean, they're big. Hinduism is my superficial knowledge is a lot related also to animals as well.
Mm-hmm.
The biblical understanding of the world, which is kind of a surprise to some persons, but you read the commentators, and now you read science, the biblical understanding of the world is that a level of consciousness, awareness, and spirituality extends throughout the entire universe,
right.
Entire world, including rocks and water,
right, right.
Let alone animals. Everything has an aspect of what we could call the divine in it.
Yes. Okay, now I want to talk to you. I want to start in on your book now, but I want to clarify a couple of things. When you, in the beginning of your book, when you're talking about the 7 days, and you said, the first day you said light and dark, came into existence. And then you talk about the universe being formed. When you say universe, what do you mean by that? Do you mean the universe of the earth? Do you mean everything that exists, all the everything that is, or what do you mean by that word?
When I say universe, I differentiate from the earth or from the solar system. The universe is the whole package.
Okay.
Everything.
So you
everything
don't
physical and spiritual.
Okay. So when you're talking about in the like the second day and you talk about universes, you mean everything that's in existence. I just want to make sure I'm clear on that.
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Wait, it's an unfolding story.
Uh-huh.
There's a sequence that's going on here in the development.
Okay.
Over the time, but the word universe refers to the entire universe.
Okay.
All aspects of existence.
So another thing I wanted to know, well, let's talk about the 7 days first. Tell us about the time measurements in the 7 days, because I found that to be fascinating, how it matches up with how they think our world, our universe is, and how you compute it. I thought that was just fascinating. Can you talk about that?
Eva, I'll tell you, when they worked out the numbers, I was almost scared. I mean, I got goose pimples all over my body. It's just extraordinary, the confluence. Look, there are several bottom line questions that always come up that at the end of a lecture, you talk for 2 hours and the person raises their hand and says, well, what about this, this, and this? And one of the several is the age of the universe. The Bible is unequivocal. It makes an explicit statement. The creation of the universe, and especially 6 days later, comes the creation of the soul of Adam. Not the body, but the soul of Adam. So there's only 6 days. So how can that be when we know between the creation of the universe and the creation of humanity is billions of years?
Mm-hmm.
From a science point of view, from the Bible, there's only 6 days.
Right.
The simplistic answer, simplistic answer is, well, the days weren't really days. They were long periods of time. And that's an interesting answer, except, and here's the reason we're using ancient commentary, except all ancient commentary, with no exception, tells us that the days of Genesis are 24 hours each. The Talmud makes this statement explicit in a section called Holidays, Hagiga. The Talmud's a commentary written down approximately 1,600 years ago, 1,600 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Rashi, the famous commentator Rashi, who lived in the year about approximately 1090, says explicitly the word day in the 6 days of Genesis from the very first day means 24 hours. And the Kabbalah, is not mysticism, it's the spiritual physics of the world. It's brought by the commentator Nachmanides, with an N, Nachmanides, the major Kabbalistic commentary, says day means 24 hours. Now that's strange, because why were these ancient commentators so insistent to tell us the day, the word day, the Hebrew word yom, means 24 hours? That's what yom means.
Mm-hmm.
Day, that's the word day means that in the Bible. One answer is because the sun is not mentioned till day number four, although all the commentators say the sun was there earlier, it just becomes visible on day four, visible through the clouds. So the entire commentary on this duration of the day reads like this. The 6 days of Genesis are 24 hours each. They are not longer than the 6 days of our work week. For the Hebrew listeners, Moshe Yemei Avodah. They're not longer than the 6 days of our work week. However, contain all the ages of the universe. They contain all the ages of the universe. How can it be that 6 days, 24 hours each, not longer than the 6 days of our work week, are the same as we understand days now? We're not talking about sunrise, sunset. We're talking about units of 24 hours. How can they equal the billions of the years? How can they contain all the ages? And the commentators bring the answer. That's what's so extraordinary. If a person looks at the Hebrew text or a good English translation, at the end of each of the six days, the day is numbered. The sentence repeats itself 6 times over in Genesis chapter 1. There was evening and morning, day one, evening and morning, a second day, evening and morning, a third day, evening and morning, a fourth day, a fifth day, the sixth day. So the question arises immediately, not by me, but by these commentators. Look at how the numbers change. There's evening, morning, day one. But then the Bible doesn't say there's evening, morning, day two. It says there's a second day, a third day. Why didn't the Bible write there's evening, morning, a first day? Why did it say day one? And the answer is extremely interesting. The text, the commentary is, remember, the commentary is almost 1,000 years ago, was that the only time that you can use the word first, like it was evening, morning, the first day, is when it's relative to an already existing second day. But at that time, at the very beginning, there was no second day. There was only one day, the first day. And from that we learn that the calendar of the Bible, for the 6 days, which forms its own calendar, people may not really realize that, but the biblical calendar is broken into two parts. The first part is the 6 days, which is the calendar that stands by itself. And the second part is from Adam going forward. The 6,000 years that we add up is always from Adam and not from the creation of the universe. The 6 days have always been a separate calendar that predates even the Talmud. So it's not something modern to bend the Bible. So the text says there's even only one day, because for the 6 days of Genesis, the Bible doesn't see time from Sinai, looking back when Moses gets the Bible on the revelation on Sinai. It doesn't see those from Sinai. We see from Adam forward. But for the 6 days of Genesis, the information that Moses got on Sinai sees time from a different perspective, from the only time in the history of time when there had not yet been a second day, and that's on the first day. The Bible sees time for the 6 days in Genesis from the beginning looking forward. Now, why that should have interested a commentator 1,000 years ago, I don't have a clue. I know I interest everyone today that's into astronomy, because the understanding of the universe is that the perception of time is totally dependent on from where you view it. There are places in not in the solar system, but in the Milky Way, where the conditions are so extreme, gravity so high, velocity so high, that if you could stand those conditions, which a human couldn't, but if you could, time would be so stretched out, so slow, that you would age 6 days while the rest of the universe aged billions of years. But I want to put that aside now and get to actually the discussion that I have in the Science of God. But what we discover from what the ancient commentators told us, that seeing time from the beginning, looking forward for the 6 days of Genesis, means we have to take all the information that we have about the history of the universe, exploding stars, the formation of the Earth approximately 4.6 billion years ago, the origin of life, it's all these events. And we have to project the perspective, how they would be seen back from the near the beginning looking forward. But astronomers all tell us that when you're taking information as we observe it on Earth and project it back in history, you're going back to a time when the universe was smaller. The listeners may be aware of the fact that the universe is stretching out, it's expanding from a very small point of the creation.
So does the... I'm sorry?
Go ahead, no.
Oh, so does the expansion of the universe and the stretching of time, is that what made those first 6 days experience different time as far as we're concerned? Does that make sense?
100% correct. 100%. That the Bible sees time looking forward when the universe is vastly smaller, vastly, vastly smaller than it is today. These ancient commentaries tell us where the clock begins, mm-hmm. when energy changed into matter. I mean, Eva, you have to realize, of course, this was 1,000 years ago. These commentators are talking about energy changing into matter. It took an Einstein to figure that out. It took an Einstein 100 years ago to figure it out, 105 years ago. I mean, it's how they understood, but those explicit statements, the clock of the Bible, when we run the information back in time, that stretching of space, but going back in time now compresses, also compresses time at exactly the same rate. Every astronomer would just say, so what else is there? Of course that's the case. It's so common in astronomy, that approach, that it's like nothing, you know, what else is new in the news today?
Right.
But what is news is the amount of stretching that astronomers tell us today, which is approximately a trillion, that's 12 zeros, a million. When you compress our understanding of the universe of 14 or 15 billion years, when you divide, when you squeeze that back, when you divide, let's say, 15 billion years, billion has 9 zeros, trillion has 12 zeros. When you make that division, you come out to 6 days. It's kind of extraordinary.
Yeah, I found that amazing. So basically, so my listeners understand, because this is quite complicated, you're saying that before Adam came, it really wasn't 6 days. It was really like, 15 billion years, right?
From our perspective of time, as we view time, but from the Torah's perspective, from the Bible's perspective, for the first chapter of Genesis, the perspective of time is not from the earth looking back in history.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the beginning looking forward. There are two different perspectives of time in the Bible. And that perspective of looking forward, I know it sounds complex. That's when the science of God, I spent a few chapters trying to just lead the reader by the hand.
It really is wonderful, but I just want to make sure, since they don't have a book in front of them, that they understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I apologize for the complexity, but the world isn't simple.
That's right.
But it's beautiful.
I have to ask the question everybody wants to know. If the Bible's true, why doesn't it mention dinosaurs? That's what your book starts out as, and everybody wants to know that question.
Yeah, the opening is, what about dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to avoid complexity, but the Bible, it doesn't have, look, the Bible doesn't talk about a lot of things. It doesn't talk about orange juice, or we have orange juice for breakfast. But why does it talk about dinosaurs? If you get away from the translations, the difficulty is the subtleties either are often in the Hebrew and they're lost in translations. But in verse 21 of Genesis chapter 1, there's a statement that God creates, and there's a whole list of animals, and one of them is the big lizards or the big whales, or it depends what translation you take, but the word is taninim. You learn in the book of Exodus, I'm trying to keep this more simple now, you learn in the book of Exodus that the Hebrew word taninim means reptiles. God created the big reptiles.
Okay.
And the biggest reptiles that ever lived. Were they were dinosaurs, I wouldn't say. But I think something's intriguing that I don't have in the book, but I just realized it after the book was published. The word dinosaur is two Greek words, dinosaurus, the big reptiles. In fact, had we translated the Bible into Greek correctly, it would have said God created the dinosaurs.
Interesting.
The big tiny name, which is the Hebrew, the word tiny means reptiles. So does it talk about dinosaurs? In fact, if you translate the two Greek words, dinosaurs, into English, you get big reptiles.
So it does. It's just a linguistics issue. All right, it's 20 after, and I have a lot of questions about mind and intention and free will, so let's try to get as many of these questions in here as we can, because we get to go till 5 before the hour, okay? So
I'm all for it, because really the question is...
First of all, I want to ask you, you talked about something in your book I have never seen anywhere. We're kind of going to go out of order, but this is important to me. You talked about how Adam was born, but he didn't get Neshama until he was 20. And you also talked about whether or not Eve was his only mate, and that there were the beings that were not conscious, so to speak, that were, mating and bringing about offspring. So that made me really curious about levels of consciousness, gradients of conscious awareness now, or why some people are murderers and why some people are saints. So I'd like to hear what you have to say about all that.
Well, I will say the questions are intriguing. I'll go in the order that you brought them in. But I have to make it clear, I'm talking about commentaries 1,000 years ago. When it's
I
my
understand.
Idea, to know. Okay.
You've obviously been thinking about this stuff for a long time, like the rest of us, and you have new information, so it's great to hear it.
Well, I took the trouble to write it down. According to our understanding from the subtlety, the wording text, in verse 26, we learn that Adam, God says, let us make Adam. But in verse 27, God creates the Adam. That's the nuance that I learned for a woman.
26 and 27 of what?
I beg your pardon. I apologize. I should be more clear.
That's all right.
Genesis chapter 1.
Okay.
Genesis chapter 1.
Okay.
It's fine. Genesis chapter 1, we learn that God makes Adam, verse 26, and then God creates the Adam. That's verse 27 of Genesis chapter 1. And thank you for priming, stopping me on these things. I want to make it intelligible. So that transition from making Adam to creating the Adam, the creation of the Adam is Adam's soul. All of ancient commentary and all of modern physics holds that the whole expresses the understanding that there was only one physical creation. That's God creates the heavens and the earth. And from the science point of view, is the Big Bang. You know, with the Big Bang, we don't know what made it bang, but something made it. The Bible says it's God that did the creation. Anybody still holds scientifically that there was one creation of stuff, and everything is made from that energy of the Big Bang. And then, so the creation, in chapter 1, verse 27, when God creates the Adam, that's the soul, as you said, the neshama, the soul of human life. And that changed an animal into a human, according to the commentaries going back over 1,000 years. There were beings, there were animals, that were coexisting with Adam and predating Adam, that were 100% human, exactly human, in shape and in intelligence, but they lacked spirituality of the neshama. They had a consciousness, but they didn't have the spiritual consciousness that humans have. According to our understanding of the physics of the science today, a level of consciousness exists throughout all of existence. Every aspect has an aspect of mind, obviously not like the level of a human mind, but we don't speak bacteria language. But when you watch how bacteria behave under a microscope, you would say there's a mind in there somehow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, microbes, bacteria, speak bacteria language, and they communicate with molecules.
Right.
So at every level of existence, there is a level, at every level of complexity, put it this way, from microbes to worms to, we should all be so lucky we could ever make a microbe, and they're so complex, but in how we see relative complexity. In all these levels here, it is a level of consciousness. It sounds bizarre, but when you watch these reactions under a microscope, there's no other way of saying it. Whether it's conscious as we understand it, we have no idea. All we do is watch the reactions. But the fact is we see microbes communicating with each other, transferring information that we measure exactly as they transfer pieces of their genetic information or the DNA that we talk about so much, that one microbe, one bacterium, might see another bacterium or become aware of another bacterium that's lacking a piece of information.
Okay, I have a question. A couple of questions, if you don't mind. I have a couple questions.
Am I getting too complex?
No. I have two questions here. One of them, the first one is, how far back before Adam were these other beings, other human beings?
Well, they weren't human. They were hominids.
Okay. How far back?
They didn't have an neshama.
How much before Adam do you think they were, or do you have any idea?
70,000 years.
Okay.
70,000 years. Beginning of Homo sapiens sapiens.
Okay.
They were Homo sapiens sapiens. They were us, but they lacked the soul.
I understand. So, where they came from, the source of intention in the creation, or is that where they came from? God.
Tell me more what you mean by that.
I try to avoid religious problems, like you were talking about earlier. So people call God or Buddha or whatever they all are, so I call it source of intention, you know, the creator.
Okay, it's wonderful because then it relates to all humanity, yeah.
Yeah, and so I want to know, did they get, what day did they get created, or do you have any idea?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you work through the numbers, it becomes, okay, they're all from day six.
Okay.
And way along on day six.
Okay.
Very close to Adam. And on a cosmic scale, 70,000 years is real short.
Yes,
I mean, it's not compared to the age of the universe.
So the next thing I want to ask you is, wait a minute, I lost my train of consciousness, shoot. Well, let me just ask you this. Do you think that in human beings today, there are gradients in conscious awareness that perhaps has something to do with that, with how their line of heritage originally started out with soul. Does that make sense?
The question makes a lot of sense. I would say that it's obvious that there's different levels of intelligence among people. Okay.
I don't mean intelligence now. I mean
I understand. I hear you.
Conscious awareness.
Yeah. Right. So I would say that in parallel to this, there might be differences in conscious awareness. But the source of intention mm-hmm. has imbued all humans with the ability to become aware of this oneness that pervades in the universe. The intricacies of the oneness and understanding how it can be that, you know, that just may take some brain power, which we know differs from person to person. But the spark of consciousness that you say from the source of intention exists.
Well, I guess
in all
the reason I'm asking this question, I don't know if you're familiar with David Hawkins' work, Power versus Force, and the research he did there with kinesiology. In his work, he found that there were 11 levels of conscious awareness in human beings. And it's like, I'm going to use my family for an example, because that way I'm not stepping on anyone's toes. But I was raised in fundamental Christianity. I later converted to Judaism, and now I'm nothing but spiritual. But when you try to talk to somebody that's a fundamentalist, and whatever it is that they're a fundamentalist about, it's like, you're talking to a telephone pole, and they will not hear what you are saying. They will not get it. You know, it's like talking to a telephone pole, but yet they think you're a know-it-all. So, and they may have gone through, you know, 12 years of college, but they still can't get it when it comes to spirituality or oneness. They can't get it. Does that make sense?
It makes not only does it make sense, it's clear from conversations you have with people. It's not, you know, that's not a theory. It's your, you know, it's your experience of reality and everyone's experience of reality that when you discuss these things, you get different responses. That inability, I think, to accept this idea, what you just were describing, may come more from how the person is raised.
Conditioning,
but wait, you see, you either just said that you were born into a very strict type of a family, then you made some self-life choices and changed your understanding. So it is possible to re-examine what you learned, but it's hard. Obviously, you are rare. It's not, I mean, I'm not patting you on the back, you know.
Well, it's not good or bad. It's like 5 or 50, you know, but I didn't have any choice in what happened to me, Jerry. It happened to me. I understood oneness in the blink of an eye. I wasn't looking for it. It just happened. Now, let's get back to you. I don't want to get off on me.
That's interesting, though.
You have no idea. I thought I was going crazy. I didn't know where it came from. But anyway, so...
But that's I think what you just said is extraordinary, because that's the basic. I don't know about Eastern religions, but I will say it's almost certain that all of the understanding in the world... If every major religion, when I say religion, I mean thought system that's trying to probe the really deep questions, not just the question of how you purify water, which is crucial, but physical survival, but probe these questions of the essence of existence, everyone comes back to the idea that there is a oneness that pervades all existence. And in Judaism, the statement is, it's Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Jesus quotes this also, Mark and Matthew, that's the most fundamental statement. And that statement, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, in the simplistic reading tells you there's one God. But that's not the message. That's the simple answer. The deeper answer is that there's a oneness that every human being can tap into. It pervades everything. Everything. Because everything extends from the singular, as you call it, the source of intention.
I've always told everybody, if there was more than one God, don't you think they would have a battle and one of them that was the most powerful would come up and say, hey, I'm it? Here's a question I have for you as a scientist. Knowing what you do about spirituality. I don't want to use religion, but spirituality. How do you think intention, or how do you think thought or creativity is conveyed from what I call big mind or God, the source of intention? How is it conveyed from the field of the quantum fluctuation, whatever you want to call it, I don't know what to call it, into the human mind? Is it by, you know, electromagnetic signaling, you know, that kind of like Morse code with voltage behind it? Or how does God convey what he wants us to know to our brain, mind?
I wonder, my brother-in-law, Gil Galler, had a very interesting thought on that. I give it his name. It could be by electromagnetic signaling, but I don't think it is. I think it's much more ethereal. I think it's not related necessarily to the physical world directly. But if you think about the cellular telephone that you've got, and in the room where you are right now, and in the room where I am, 9,000 miles away from you, there are literally tens of thousands of signals going through this room. My phone doesn't pick them up because it's sensitive to something different from them.
So if it's not signaling, what is it?
No, it is signaling, but you're not sensitive to it. If we can imprint on a single wave of light, electromagnetic radiation, which is the fancy word for light, if we can imprint on a light beam, literally, because that's how it works, millions of pieces of information, tens of millions, if we can do it, I mean, obviously the source of intention, the source of the universe itself, can do even more than that. The fact is that would be one way of carrying all the information.
Mm-hmm.
But my thinking is, I think, what I see here is getting a separation between brain and mind, between consciousness and the awareness of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
My opinion is, and there are vast amounts of data coming out of quantum physics that say that there's an aspect of existence. The fundamental aspect is not the material world that we experience, but that there's a spiritual substrate, and totally ethereal. And, you know, I mean, just as a quick thought experiment for people listening, there's no sound in a brain. There is zero sound in your brain. But I'm hearing you, and you're hearing me. Where are we hearing it?
Yeah.
We know the chemistry. The chemistry is known. But how do we perceive, how and where do we perceive that chemistry? There are a lot of data that tell us that would be mind. The brain gets the information. It's like the radio picking up the radio waves. So,
all right, I have two more questions now that you just made me think of by saying what you said. I'm going to state them and then you answer them, okay? The first one is every single highly evolved human being that I personally have ever talked to about this issue that I know is what I call consciously awake and understands oneness. We hear a sound in our head. You may hear it too. Do you hear a high pitch frequency in your head?
Continuously.
Yes.
Continuously.
Well, I was talking to Irvin Laszlo about that. I don't know if you know who Irvin Laszlo is. But he's a systems, I forget what you call it, but
systems analyst.
Yeah. Well, Irving said, Eva, it's B flat. Is that B flat, you know, before the universe had anything in it, it was void and silent, and even silence is a frequency. So is that the note of silence, B flat? Is that the frequency that the original intention was placed upon to start atoms knocking and bumping into each other to create mass? Then I want to know, do you think that we really exist in just a hologram?
I don't think we exist in a hologram, but I do think that that the basis of existence, that there's a spirit. Oh, I guess you could, if you took an extreme view of that, you could say this idea of a hologram. I don't have a concretized or a specific understanding of what's called duality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know that there's this idea of a wave and a particle duality that was discovered in the early 1900s. that all of matter is also a wave,
like
a wave on a sea.
Right.
But it's also particles like ping pong balls.
Mm-hmm.
And we can never see both at the same time. You either see it as our brains are particle oriented. We only experience the world through particle interactions. But we conceive of those interactions as through particle interactions. But the fact is, there's a whole other world of waves. How the world would appear if we could conceive of waves would probably, I don't think it'd be necessarily a hologram, but it would be, I mean, a person that's listening, just envision a wave in an ocean. The wave in the ocean, it's very hard to see where the wave begins. You can see the very peak of it, you know, the crest, that's obvious. But then it slopes down in both directions. It doesn't end anywhere, really. You know, they overlap. So the world becomes fuzzy, cloudy. It's not, but now getting back to your question, B flat. I'm not enough of a musician to relate to that directly, but how the source of intention imbued intention into the world is, I think, best stated by the late, the blessed memory, brilliant biologist and organic chemist, George Wald, Harvard University, Nobel laureate, in which he tells us explicitly that the essence of existence, I'd like to, if I can put my hand on the quote immediately, I'll read it to you, I'll just do it from memory, that the essence of existence, the total essence of existence, is mind, M-I-N-D, mind, he writes like this. It has occurred to me lately, and this is in a peer-reviewed journal, the peer-reviewed journal of International Quantum Chemistry, peer-reviewed for the persons that listen and are not aware of it, means before it gets published, other scientists read it and say, does it make sense, or is it just a pipe dream? He writes, this occurred to me lately, and I must confess with shock at first to my scientific sensibilities, that the question of consciousness, the origin of consciousness, in humans, and of life from non-living matter, can be brought to some degree of agreement, congruence. This is with the assumption that mind, is the essence of existence. It is, the universe is the expression of mind, which is exactly what you're saying with the source of intention. So if the universe is the expression of mind, and this mind is present everywhere, we experience the world physically. Look, there's no question about, we can't deny that. But the essence of existence is far below what we superficially experience. Whether different humans, I'm relating to the other part of the question, whether different humans have different levels of awareness, I think for certain, that's absolutely certain. Does it make one better than the other, more deserving more life? No, it doesn't. I mean, that's just a pure gift. The person that's brilliant has no right to be conceited about brilliance. It's just a gift. You know?
Right.
You work to become brilliant, you got it. But I think just as some people are smarter than others, some persons have greater understanding of this, or tap into this oneness. Oneness is the example. Oneness is it. Oneness is the source of love.
All right, I got two more questions, and we got 10 minutes to do these questions. I want to talk about free will. Do you think that we have complete free will? Because I tell this to everybody, if we had complete free will, you could say, Eva, meet me at Starbucks at 3 o'clock. We'd both be there at 3, we wouldn't be there 5 minutes after or 5 minutes before, we wouldn't forget, we wouldn't get a flat tire, we wouldn't get lost, we'd be there at 3 o'clock. The other thing that relates to free will, I guess this is just a way to say it maybe, do you think we're driving the car? And I tell a story, imagine that you're a child strapped in a car seat in the back seat with a little yellow steering wheel, and God's driving the car. You think you're driving that car as being that little child. You turn that steering wheel and turn that steering wheel, but you get down to the stop sign and you want to go right to the playground and God wants to go left to the grocery store. And at that moment, you realize you're not, your steering wheel doesn't work. So I want to know, do you think we have complete free will? So I guess it's really one question just worded funny. From a scientific perspective, how does that work?
From a scientific perspective, for almost 200 years, following de Laplace's understanding, the scientist funded de Laplace, who proposed that the universe was a clockwork universe, that it was wound up in the beginning and the laws of nature controlled the world. That was until the early 20th century, approximately 90 or 95 years ago. That was the understanding. There was no place for free will. And then the world was discovered not to be a clockwork universe, but the world was more like a cloud or a wave, that the world isn't defined exactly by any condition because of quantum uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
What quantum uncertainty means in implications is it doesn't need to be understood at the moment. But really, in essence, what the ultimate result of quantum uncertainty is that the conditions right now do not fix the conditions a microsecond from now or a moment from now. So the world is not fixed, which opens the door for intention and free will. How does that come in? It comes in by the fact that you feed information into your brain, and you make your decisions based on what you fed into the brain. The idea of whether we have complete free will we don't have the essence for total free will, because physically we may will ourselves to jump over a gigantic hurdle and we can't do it physically.
Well, so, question here. How do you know that that wasn't the source of creativity, or the source of intentions, plan for you to jump over that big rock? How do you know,
that
you willed it or chose it?
I think Louis Pasteur says, chance favors the prepared mind. How do I know if I willed it or chose it? I don't know if I will. I think you're correct. There are questions that I don't know the ultimate answer. We don't know the ultimate answers to, but I do think that we do have this, that God has pulled back, or the Creator, the source of intention, has pulled back, and in other words, are we being dragged by the parent driving the car? And you see this beautiful analogy. Thank you. It's a nice, beautiful analogy. But the kid in the back. I would say it almost works that way, except for the fact I have to go back to, from the science point of view and from the biblical point of view. From the science point of view, for sure that we have a slack in the system. It's called quantum uncertainty. That quantum uncertainty is built in, which means that the universe is not a clockwork universe and that we can interact with that. But our free will is not totally free, because the environment is acting on it also. You want to be there at 3 o'clock, and your will is to be there at 3 o'clock at Starbucks. You know what? You get a flat tire, and you get there at 4 o'clock. And you didn't will that. Now, you could say, well, did God make me have that flat tire? Sometimes I think the answer would be yes, and sometimes the answer would be just chance. From a biblical point of view, that's the difficulty, that accidents do happen in the world, but not everything is an accident.
Do you think God has emotion? Because emotion is what? Norepinephrine and dopamine and serotonin. And I don't think there's norepinephrine and dopamine and serotonin floating around in the universe. So does God just observe? Is incarnating into human beings and dogs and cats and rocks and trees, is that how God experiences emotion? And we got about 6 or 7 minutes.
I have a book, God Wearing, coming out in the spring, called God According to God. And it just takes the Bible, how God is described in the Hebrew Bible, and I draw my conclusions from that. If you want the conclusion that I have from the Hebrew Bible, God has emotions. I don't think it takes serotonin, dopamine, and all those things at all. That's how it works in humans. It's just that this totally ethereal non-thing that the Bible calls God, or the source of intention.
I have a question here. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but we're so short on time. If God has emotions, then that means God's judgmental, and I thought everything was perfect with God.
God says right before if I take the biblical point of view, then your thoughts about God, Eva, I hate to say it, are wrong. The Bible may be wrong, I'm saying, okay? But if the Bible is correct, in chapter 6, verse 7 of Genesis, right before the mythological or real flood, doesn't matter to me whether you see it as a myth or a reality, but God says, I regret having made the world.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, interesting, yeah. Never thought about it that way, but...
I beg your pardon?
It's interesting. Never thought about that. I recall that being said somewhere.
Yeah, it's a straight statement. It's not an ancient comment that's right in the Bible. What it means, what it tells me is that, this is sound bizarre, but I think this source of intention, I'm about to offend all your listeners, I have a feeling, this source of intention is learning how to run the universe. That's what it sounds like to me. That the that there are aspects in the world, even that this all-knowing oneness that pervades everything, but they're, like, just like your free will has interactions with the, you get the flat tire, you miss your appointment, even though you wanted to make the appointment. This world has things going in it. Does God know that that's the source of intention from the biblical word of God? Know that this is going to happen right from the beginning? It depends how you think about knowledge. You know, inside of time or outside of time. Inside of time, future exists. Outside of time, everything is simultaneous. Either there are aspects of existence that we cannot understand. I know it sounds like a cop-out, but a human cannot factor out of the thoughts timelessness. Time is one of the aspects of existence that's built into our brains and built into our thought system, time.
What?
And we can't conceive of being outside of time.
I have to make this comment, and then we're going to have to stop, because I want you to tell people your website and everything, but I don't totally agree that that's not possible, because there are mystics that have experienced total oneness as, I don't know how to describe, I've done it before, only one time. But it was like I was everything at one time, but I had no eyes or ears, but I could still see, and I was just this one big thing. I don't know how to describe it, but I think that it is possible to have that experience if you get into an altered state of mind, meditate, or whatever it is that, you know, gets you there. I think it's a possible thing to do.
I think you can experience the oneness.
I don't mean just regular oneness, like looking at the world as a different place with agape. I mean space and time, or lack thereof. I mean, I don't know how to describe it. I just wanted you to know that there something is there that is possible to experience. Anyway, it's 10:52. We got 3 minutes, and I want you to tell. We never tell people your website and where to find your book or how to contact you. So I want you to tell them that right now. So we got 2.5 minutes left.
Okay, and if you send, I answer emails. But I don't open attachments, and I just can't answer long emails. But I'm happy to get emails if there's comments people aren't criticizing, except, and that's GS, like my name, Gerald Schroeder, GS at GeraldSchroeder.com, GeraldSchroeder.com. And my website is www.GeraldSchroeder.com.
And I have to tell you, good book, Dr. Schroeder. Excellent book. I mean, whether somebody agrees with every sentence or not, it sure is some food for thought. Really is.
I appreciate you saying that. The science of God has the impact that it's had on me from the emails that I get, thank God, literally from around the world, including a bunch from the South Pole, believe it or not, from a research station in the South Pole. So that's how I found you.
One of some random person that found my website, ran across my website, sent me an email and said, you need to interview this guy. It's the greatest book. I'm reading it right now. And that's how I found you. So word's getting out there.
Well, that's the science of God. I think people might find, can I mention my new book coming
Absolutely.
Out? It's called God According to God. Harper's Publishing, Harper One. It should come out in about May, I think, May of 2009. We're in the final editing now.
I'm going to have to call you and get you to come back because I still have about 30 more questions.
I appreciate. This is a great way. You're ending your day, but I'm starting the day. It's just getting light here in Jerusalem. The horizon is just getting light, and I tell you, Eva, this is a wonderful way to start a day. I really appreciate the conversation.
It's just my pleasure. How is the situation over there? Is it safe? And
thank God, it is mobbed with tourists. I mean, I live in Jerusalem, and I teach in the old city. I bicycle from where I teach on the about a 30-minute bike ride from where I teach, and I across Jerusalem. When I can tell how the world is feeling about Israel, about whether I have to keep getting off my bike because there's so many people walking. I mean, the news you get, you can't help it. The news is often highly skewed, but the fact is, it's not totally peaceful. But so far, thank God, we're managing, and the level of danger is vastly different than it was 10 years ago. Vastly different.
Well, I'm glad
to
hear that.
What will happen in the future? You never know in the future, but at the moment it's a nice day. It's a nice calm day, blue sky. We could use rain actually. That's the situation here. We've got a drought. We need rain.
Us too. Well, expect to hear from me. I'm going to send you an email and try to reschedule you for summer. And thank you so much, and agape to you, Dr. Schroeder.
Thank you, and I think your idea of the source of intention is a brilliant way of seeing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night. Good morning. Bye bye.
Yeah. Right.